Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. New York City is a far cry from rural Blue Hill, Maine. Population 2,000. No one knows that better than comedian Emma Willman, who lived there until she left for Boston to attend Simmons College. She stayed in Boston for a while, where, in her words, tried to invent something, failed, and then got into stand-up while working as a recruiter. Emma made a name for herself on Boston's comedy circuit. In fact, in 2011, she won first place in Boston's Comedy Riots and was featured in the 2011 and 2012 Boston Women in Comedy Festival. From there, grad school in New York City. But Emma really wanted to be in the Big Apple to pursue comedy. And basically, the rest is history. In 2014, she was featured on the cover of Time Out New York as one of the top 10 funniest females in New York City. She was also a top 10 finalist in New York's Funniest at Caroline's on Broadway, headlined her own show in the New York Comedy Festival at Stand Up New York, toured the college circuit, and appeared on TV in such shows as Deadly Affairs, True Crime, My Crazy Love. Emma made her national stand-up television debut on Access TV's Live at Gotham, hosted by Louis Anderson. 2015 has also been a busy year. Emma's appeared at several comedy festivals and was on the cover of Go Magazine, appeared in a viral video for Dear Kate Underwear, and was a regular on the Week in Sex podcast taped live at the Sex Museum in Manhattan. I'm sure there's a story there. Emma, welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Absolutely. That was a great job with intro.
Well, hey, I didn't make it up, right? You know. So, did you always have the sense that you were funny, A, and B, how much did growing up in Blue Hill, Maine play a role in who you are?
I always did have a sense that I was funny, not because I was trying to be funny, but more because kids would just laugh when I was talking. And then I didn't know if it was because I was always a very eccentric kid. And I remember there was this point where I just became, this is going to sound a little weird,
okay,
where I became loud. Like, there was a point where I just became loud in class, and that corresponded with my parents had a really messy divorce. So in second grade, my parents had, I was an imaginative, very imaginative kid before that, and kind of silly, but I wasn't like, not that being loud necessarily has anything to do with being funny, but if you're kind of funny and you are loud, then people are going to maybe notice that. And I remember in second grade, I would come in and do different characters. And it was kind of, I think, trying to disassociate with reality, because my reality at the time was hard because my parents were just having this blowout of a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And I even remember I had a teacher. This is third grade. She was like, Emma, if you just be quiet during class, I'll pass you maybe, and I'll give you 5 minutes at the end of the class to tell your silly little stories. Have you heard of a Waldorf school?
Is it like kind of Montessori-ish?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Exactly. It's inspired by Rudolf Steiner, too, I think.
I know that name.
Mm-hmm. So she is very just kind of like they can play with the structure of it a little bit. So she would give me 5 minutes at the end of class to tell my stories, and then people would kind of request that I would do a story again.
I mean, that's really,
isn't that funny?
Odd.
Oh, so weird.
Yeah, weird's a better word. So you did stand up in Miss Jones's class?
I was just telling stories, made up stories. I would sit during recess and kind of like watch what was going on. Once I started doing these little shows at the end of the class, I kind of became more reclusive during the day because I would spend recess kind of like, oh, you know, my friend Margot brought this in for lunch. Well, what would happen if, you know, maybe she got it and then a monster took it and blah, 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 blah. So then I would tell stories like that.
So you would start with something real.
Exactly.
Kind of riff on it in a fantasy way.
Exactly.
And then
that was my MO. That was definitely before eighth grade, because I distinctly remember in eighth grade, all the teachers had up until eighth grade were like, yeah, you can do little stories at the end of class. And I got in eighth grade and the teacher was like, what are you talking about? That was the end of that. So eighth grade was the kind of the end of it. And I actually, interestingly enough, started getting in trouble in eighth grade. So I don't know if once I didn't have that outlet, I started kind of acting out.
I was just going to use that term, acting out, with this kind of tough situation at home.
Yes. And I was really fat. I was overweight. I was an mm-hmm. overweight kid, and mm-hmm. I'm dyslexic, and I'm gay. So I think not knowing how to deal with those things kind of created a cocktail of
Well,
anger.
When did all of these things come to light? I mean, dyslexia obviously came first, right?
Let me see. Well, I think being the overweight kid came first.
Obviously,
and then,
yes.
And then dyslexia, I was diagnosed. My parents started noticing something was up, but it was corresponding so much with all these other things kind of going on. So it's always hard, like with dyslexia or ADD, to pinpoint what the source of it is.
Were you feeling frustrated in school and angry?
So frustrated.
Oh,
man. I was frustrated too. And, you know, especially with like something like spelling or math, there's like a home video of me and I'm outside and you can hear the recording. I'm like, Karen and Tom kissing in a tree, KISS 72. Like, I have no, I can't spell. So then I was trying to do spelling bees and it became very frustrating. So what I started doing was cheating. To be a real avid cheater in school, you actually have to kind of develop like good people skills because you got to recruit people to let you cheat off of them.
For sure.
And so I had to kind of use humor to kind of butter people up to let me get those answers.
And were you successful? Were you a good cheater?
Oh, I have a master's in media. I literally have a master's. And I didn't cheat in my grad program, but I cheated all through high school. But you know who I really cheated? I cheated myself.
But the interesting thing about that is when you're talking about asking to cheat off, I remember taking the SATs.
Oh, God.
And it said, you may now go to the next page, you know, at the bottom. And I just sort of yelled out, why? You know? And that was in the math part. I mean, I think I just got points for signing my name.
You get 200 points for signing your name.
Okay, yes. So then I got 430 points.
You didn't do well in the SAT?
No, I did not. Wow. But the point is, were people willing to help you out?
In the Waldorf school, I didn't have to cheat so much.
Because
it was
grades.
All, you basically are literally like using coloring books. Like it's like very like...
Right.
Hippy dippy. And then I went away to a private school for dyslexic kids. Didn't need to cheat there because who would I have cheated off of? Everyone's in the same boat.
Good point.
And then I actually got kicked out of that. And then I went to the public school in my hometown. Boom, I started to have to cheat. And I would kind of like recruit one or two people that seemed, I mean, it's awful. To retell it, it's like they would kind of seem like insecure or shy. And then I would be like, you know, hey, can I cheat off you? And I always did student government, too. So I was very much a politician, I guess.
But, you know, you did get into college.
I did get into college. It was those essays I wrote. Oh, also, I remember not doing well in high school. And then I think by my junior year, I had started to turn it around a little bit. I tried really hard, too. So A for effort. And then I got into Simmons College.
Do you think you are who you are today as a result of what was going on in your household? And what I mean by
absolutely.
That is that you were trying to make chicken salad out of that phrase, chicken.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, growing up in such a small town, it's so interesting because everyone has to interact. So it's like I maybe in like bigger towns, like things are divided much more by class or, I mean, the town was not
distance.
Racially diverse
mm-hmm,
at all.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like class mixing or people that maybe would have been separated, like literally for our prom, the whole school had to go to the prom to make there be a prom. So if there were not literally, but like, you know, people from all the different much, it wasn't like divided by grades or people for a party. There'd be all the kids. There's only one party happening. So everyone was intermixing. So you got to interact with a lot of different, like the goth kids and the jocks. Everyone was kind of hanging out.
So
and
did that
that's nice.
Foster tolerance?
It fostered a really nice sense of community, for sure. And it also fostered just kind of like getting to be with a lot of different kinds of people. And I feel like it gives you a strong sense of self when you're growing up in such a small area, at least in terms of you have to get pretty creative to keep yourself entertained. So if you, there was a lot of kids, I mean, I don't know, maybe this is just like what kids are like anywhere, so I can't speak in it. But I know a lot of kids in my hometown were into like writing or doing creative projects. Or drugs, I guess.
But here's your dilemmas, and you stated them. You were overweight,
yes.
You were dyslexic,
yes.
And you were gay. The
yeah.
gay part of this, when did that hit you, that uh-oh?
Well, so I didn't come out until the second day of college, but I knew I was gay. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I had a crush on Nala from The Lion King. Do you remember Nala?
I don't know her personally.
Right. So I had a crush on her, and I remember my internalized homophobia was so bad, I was more embarrassed and concerned about how I had a crush on a girl than on the fact that I liked a lion, which that's pretty bad, internalized homophobia. But I always had crushes on female Disney characters, and I was also always, like, pretending I was a boy. I remember making my sister play a game called the wife game. All the game was, she was my wife, I was the husband. That was the end of the game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I sometimes would, like, poke her with a stick, and my parents would be like, where did you get this depiction of a relationship? This is disgusting. But so I knew that something was a little different there. And then in high school, I started to think I was gay. So to cope with it, I pretended I was homophobic. I was like, I hate gay people.
The other extreme.
Yes. Whoa. Which I think people do. When you get scared of what you are.
Sure.
You're trying to lash out.
Yeah, you didn't
out.
Invent that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a very common thing, mm-hmm. obviously. So mm-hmm. I would be like, and I remember being like, I very, very against gay marriage. And I had a friend, Margot, who is straight, and her mom had a friend who was a lesbian. She was like, it's, you know, I don't know if I can have you over to the house. You're so homophobic. My mom's best friend's a lesbian. It's, you sound really ignorant. And I was like, ah, just look, they're brainwashing you. Just, I was just full of it. So then I came out the second day of college, but I knew in high school I was gay and I had little boyfriends because I was trying to cover it up.
During those really formative years, there was no confidant, nobody who you could talk to intimately.
I could have talked to probably a few. I remember I had this friend, Mason. I remember driving around with her and I was like, I got to tell you something. And she kept being like, okay. And then we ended up going like deep into the woods, which wasn't hard because we're in rural Maine. So that's like pretty everywhere. But then I was like, I think I'm bisexual. And she's like, okay, like that's fine. I'm sure a lot of people are. And then I was like, never mind. I love men. Bah! You know, I had a freak out.
So did I remember, you date?
I dated lots of boys in high school.
That's
but
what
the
I mean.
Second I came out of college, you know, I would say I went to an all women's college. So it was a very cushy place to come out. But I didn't really have any older people. I had a therapist I remember telling I thought I was gay, and he was like, he actually was recently in the news for having an inappropriate relationship with one of his patients. But he was like, I don't think you're gay. I think a lot of people get confused about that. So there was him. And then I had an acupuncturist who I one time drunkenly made out with a girl at a party, and she was like, well, do you think you're actually maybe gay? And I told her I thought I was. So I did talk about it with her a little bit.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Emma Willman, comedian. So comedian.
Yes.
You go to school. You're going to major in what?
So I went to school at Simmons. I majored in public relations and philosophy because I thought I wanted to work in the music industry. So being in such a rural town, I always used entertainment as like an outlet to a bigger world. Mm-hmm. And I just became fascinated with entertainment. So I was majoring in those things and interning at a recording studio in Boston. And doing student government comedy is nowhere on my radar. Okay. Didn't even watch stand-up. So that's why I chose to major in marketing and philosophy. I thought it would relate to music and entertainment somehow.
Okay, so you sort of had a goal in mind.
Yes.
A professional goal. So you graduate.
Graduate.
And then you get, for all intents and purposes, sidetracked
by
comedy.
God. So this is what happened. So I didn't do well in elementary school or high school academically. All of a sudden, college, I'm killing it, and I'm not cheating. But it was like, finally, I'm
hit your stride.
Hit my stride. Because it's like I found I was in a safe, I had a good living environment. I was like intellectually stimulated. All of a sudden, I'm doing really well. Double major, do student government.
And also, it must have been quite a weight off your shoulders to acknowledge who you were by
exactly.
saying, I'm going public with the fact that you're gay.
Exactly. Everything's going good. And, you know, I didn't really hang out with the gay kids at school. I did. I always had a lot of girlfriends. But you know, I've always been very, like, inclusive in the friend circle. So I graduate and I'm like high on life. I'm like, I killed it in college. I can do anything. So I remember started poking around and reading all these like entrepreneurial magazines. And I had always had ideas that I wanted to invent something. My grandfather, my dad's side, was an inventor. He created one of the patents for pasteurizing milk, Joseph Willman.
Wow.
Yeah. So growing up, I always saw like, you know, we have a framed patent of his around the house. So I was like, I'm going to invent something. Because I can do anything. So I tried to, I had a bunch of different ideas. I picked the one I liked the best. I got a patent pending on it, all that whole thing. Then I sent the product prototype to a scam developer. Now, while I was doing that after I graduated, I responded to an ad on Craigslist that said, do you want to make more money than the people you're graduating with? Okay. If you're listening to this and you're looking for a job on Craigslist, those ads are not legitimate. All right.
Duh.
Duh. I respond. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I get the job because it's sketchy. You know, they would get any idiot that walks in. There you go. It was like one level up. You know those door-to-door knife sales jobs?
Cutco knives, yes. I use them to stab the salespeople. Uh-huh.
It was like one level up from that. So I was doing that during the day and then working on my patent
night. Was what? What were you
going to? Oh, my God. Okay. Now, so first, my first idea was caffeinated cigarettes where I put caffeine in the filter of the cigarette, so people get addicted to the caffeine and the nicotine.
So it's two for the price of one.
Two for the price of one, and then I was like, I can't morally pursue that, plus people have already probably thought of that. Then I was like, maybe I'll try to invent something called the granny grip. Don't slip the granny grip. You know how old people have weak knees?
Right.
I got inspired because I was watching my grandma get in the tub once. I was like, ooh, it'll be a glove. They'll put it in their hands. They'll help them grip the side of the tub, help them lower themselves into the tub. The ad could be like a person falling. And it's like, do you not want your grandmother to fall and hit her head or grandfather? Don't slip. The granny
That's
grip.
That's impressive. That's impressive.
Appreciate it. But the idea that I went with was, do your pants ever scuff at the bottom from the friction between them and the ground?
Yes.
Okay. So what I tried to invent was this thing called Stop the Scuff, and how Stop the Scuff works. It's a clear plastic material that adheres seamlessly to the bottom of your pants. If you have it on, I can't see it. You can't feel it. It's like a condom for the bottom of your pants. Okay. Put it on in the morning. Take it off at night. It's good for people, you know, on the go, kids with changing pant sizes, yada, yada. So I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to make it. I've never been more, like, passionately possessed by something. I was going to young inventors meetings at MIT. I'm like, this is it. Like, I'm going to, I think I still, and I probably, I know a lot of performers, I'd be interested if other, the people that you have on get fueled by almost like an anger, or I'm going to show you, you know? So I had a lot of that as a kid. Cause also being dyslexic, I was shuffled around the special ed program and I always knew I wasn't stupid, but I hadn't found the right outlet to express that. And I was like, what can I do in a major way to show everyone that, one, they were wrong, and two, I'm a boss. So, you know, there's always the ups and downs between thinking you're like the best thing and the worst thing.
Oh,
and it's all very self-absorbed to the clearly. But I'd really try to invent something, and I would spend every lunch break just mapping it out, the marketing plan, and this guy. I like just found some random guy to create a product prototype. He was like, I'm going to get you into Kmart. And I was like, oh, my God. Oh, I'm telling everyone back home, I'm going to be a Kmart. Mm-hmm. My poor parents, because at this point I have told them I want to be a hip hop music executive. I'm going to invent something called Stop the Scuff. So they have no, they're just like, this kid.
Yes, dear.
Yes, dear. And then after that, I was like, well, it failed. So now I've got a safety plan. They're like, oh, great. This is good to hear. I'm like, I'm going to be a comedian. They're like, Jesus. So what happened is, I figure out that this product prototype guy is a scam developer. He's not sending me the stuff that he was supposed to. He starts asking for more money. And I was like, but you didn't do what you said before. So I look him up and I call the Better Business Bureau in Pennsylvania. There's a whole file on this person. And he's got under different names. I filed some suit thing, but I was so devastated. I didn't know how to file.
And humiliated.
Oh, my God. I just started talking about Stop the Scuff maybe 5 months ago.
That you just got over it, you mean?
I'm still not. It's a sensitive subject. You know what? Every time I see someone's pants scuffing around in the city, it makes me flinch. So I find out and I'm just like crushed. And I'm like, now I'm working at this job that I hate. One level up from knife salesmanship. And I basically, like, what the hell? It just kind of the reality of it hit me that I'm very impulsive too. I impulsively took this job, put all my eggs in the basket of a pants condom at the bottom of your pants working out. Like, this is not a good situation. Crushed. I went to a party with my friend. We're at this party in this basement. I turn and I look and I see a girl in the corner talking into a microphone. I went over and listened to it. And I remember she said something that someone thought was offensive and they were getting upset at her. And she was like, what? I'm just doing comedy. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Because the year before, I'd only seen comedy a few times on TV. So it's hard to self-actualize into something. It seems a very, very far off land. Like, how do you even begin to approach that when it's something, a TV production? But this person in this like dumpy basement, I was like, I could do that.
Was she funny?
So funny. She is very funny. I know her now. That night was not a good night for her because the audience was there for, there was not an audience. They were there for a house party. So they were giving her no love. But she was very nice. I went up to her and said, what do you do? You know, how do you begin? She goes, go to open mics. And her name's Alana Eisner. She's great. She started out in Boston. Now she lives in New York. But she kind of told me where to go. And I just started going to open mics and shows in Boston from there.
And so you assumed that you could do that. You're not a joke teller as much as you are a storyteller, right?
No, I try to be very careful to make sure there are constructed jokes in my stories. You always have to have a point and a destination. Like, even if you pick apart people that are storytellers, there's a pretty traditional joke structure in there, but I always try to like wrap it up in a personality. Like, I would never want someone to leave a show and be like, she's a good writer. That wouldn't happen anyway. But I wouldn't want someone to be like, she's a good writer. I want them to be like, I want to hang out with her.
But how did you just know what to do?
I didn't.
And you just figured it out yourself?
I mean, it's a
you
process.
You must have been drawing plans up for that, too, like you did for the pants.
Are you a big plotter? I'm a big plotter. I'm always like, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that.
But where did you kind of get off thinking you were funny?
Well, so ever since I was little, people would always, like even when I did student government or whatever it is, people always thought I was funny.
Okay, but, and even in your little stand-up in school.
Little stand-up. But yeah. Here's the thing. Everyone's funny. I mean, so many people are funny. People are very funny. Life
unbeknownst
is funny.
To them.
Unbeknownst to them. The difference is harnessing it and restructuring it and recreating it in a context where people don't know you. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So what I did was after I saw that and I went to an open mic and I was just up there and I started being like, I don't know where people are supposed to laugh. I think this is funny. There's got to be something else here. So I started reading comedy books and I'm like, okay, there's kind of a formula here. And I started taking comedy classes in Boston. And I just started going to open mics and then just watching and watching and watching and just, you know, I remember I would watch stand-up sets and transcribe them and started noticing patterns. And comedy is a language, for sure.
But is your, or back then, were you the brunt of your stand-up or was it observations on life?
I always kind of am pretty self, I'm self-depreciating, but you never want anyone to feel
You mean self-deprecating.
Bad. Self-deprecating.
That's
See, that's why I had to cheat. Wait, what's self-depreciating? Is that even a thing?
Probably not.
Damn it.
That's all right. But you could coin it. Right. Go ahead, go for it.
You know, I always used to confuse.
You put yourself down.
Put myself down. Mm-hmm. But you want to do it in a, you don't ever want someone to be like, oh, you want it
to. Of course not. Well, they know that it's tongue-in-cheek.
Right. I used to confuse the words condom and condominium. That was the most embarrassing. Isn't that embarrassing?
That is embarrassing.
I'd be like, my aunt and uncle want to get a condom.
So you started to just test out these open mics.
Yeah, and it's very scary, for
and
sure.
And then you started to see what? People were laughing?
Exactly. So what you do is you bring a I started noticing that people would always bring their phone up on stage. I'm like, what? That's rude. Why are they bringing their phone up? And then someone was like, no, you record yourself, and then you listen to it, and then you edit. That's something I need to get better at today. But comics are always like, oh, I need to listen to my recordings more. That's what they're referring to. You listen to your set and then you try to edit and see what people respond to, or maybe I can exaggerate this more. How can I make it get shorter? I also always try to think, is this something that's personal or special? Or you don't want to do something that's been done a bunch before either. I mean, so yeah, I just started kind of like listening to recordings and just watching as much as I could. And then so when I started comedy in Boston, I started seeing these people where I was like, oh, these guys are cool. They're like local headliners. So I started observing, okay, who are people that got out of the city and are thriving in bigger media mediums? Like, what's the difference? Because I would see people, I'm like, this person is so funny, but they're in the same show with me. They are so funny. Why are we in the same show? Why aren't they a draw?
Several steps ahead of you, kind of?
Yeah, or they say they would be ahead of me in that context, but you don't want them to say, hey, I'm going to go to this club tonight and see who's there. You want them to go, hey, where, say, Bob. Okay, me and you, we're going to go, let's go to this comedy club. Oh, Bob happens to be there. Great, Bob's great, very funny. That's one thing. The real thing here is, I don't care where Bob is at. He's there, then we're going
following
there.
Him.
That's when, and that takes years and years and years, and that's a whole, you know, that's a huge honor and beautiful thing to cultivate. But I would see these people, I'm like, they are so funny. What's the discrepancy between them and someone else who's funny, but the other person who's funny is a draw? Because sometimes it's not, sometimes you could see two people together and they're both hilarious, but one person has created something that the other person hasn't. And I became fascinated with that. And that's also when I went to grad school, I studied media studies, did a thesis on celebrity construction and monetization in the United States and how it relates to capitalism. How do you turn a person into a product?
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Emma Willman, comedian. What's the thrust of your humor? Is it your sexuality?
No! Oh my God. You can't. That influences my humor for sure because it's a part of who I am. But I get so scared actually doing gay shows. I always used to, and I used to almost not do them because I would never want to be stuck in that circuit.
Or just to be pigeonholed in that sense?
Oh, my God. I would wake up with nightmares about lesbian cruises. Like, you know, to be, oh, I mean, I used the L word already. Just put
but
a
look
fork
at someone
in
like
it.
Kate
Loser
Clinton,
city.
Who uses her sexuality in her humor. And
yeah,
she's
great.
Hilarious.
Very
yeah.
funny. I've opened up for her, and she was a real class act. Mm-hmm. She was great. She's a really kind, funny, smart person. She's doing her thing.
Right. So your comedy is observational.
So my comedy is I talk a lot about being from a small town. I talk a lot about my family. My mom, I talk about, even though I didn't grow up with her, I love her very much, but she's a real character. So I've kind of, I talk about her a lot. I do talk about my sexuality, and I try to talk about things that I see. I talk about being dyslexic, things that I see are wrong and aren't funny, and try to build from there. Like, I have been trying forever to write jokes about the how the prison system is privatized and how I think that that's problematic. I have not found a way to make it funny whatsoever, but I'm trying to do that. That's very observational, and a problem with something like that is it's like a lot of people could tackle that, and I have no doubt a lot of people would tackle it way better than I could.
Where are you today?
I haven't been doing comedy that long. Like, I was doing it 2 years in Boston. I came to New York. No, I was doing it a year and a half. No, 2 years in Boston, came to New York, was doing comedy 2 years, and I really crashed and burned. And I was drinking constantly. And then when I graduated, and I remember I was drinking constantly, and I was obsessed with, I got to get an agent. I got to get a manager. And I started becoming obsessed with what other people are doing. Whenever you are in a creative field, I feel, and you start looking around, it's not good. Sometimes you want to look around to scale things, but you got to keep your eye on the prize and just, you want to get, if you're undeniable, you won't be denied. But I crashed and burned, and I actually stopped, and I took a year off. I just didn't do stand-up. I moved back to Boston. I got a job selling educational travel, and I had a great year. I saw this great therapist. I got, like, very, like, healthy, and I had to figure out, do I really want to go for this? Do I really want to try to put myself through that entertainment machine? And I wasn't sure, but I really, you know, it's such a commitment. It's a lifestyle. It's everything. So you have to be really sure you want to do that. And after a year in Boston, I decided, yeah, I want to go for this. I had to figure out the pure reasons that I did love it. And I had to be okay more with the process of it. So I started doing stand-up again about 2 years ago.
Are you successful? Or do you work on the side as an accountant?
Well, so I do not have a day job because I got into, like, more, there's something called NACAs, the National Association of Campus Activities, than any other act this past season. So I'm doing a huge college tour. Am I successful? I mean, I probably do like 13 to 14 shows
a week.
You
earn a living.
Yeah, I do 13 to 14 shows a week. I open up for the cast of Girl Code on the Road. I mean, I headline. But to me, successful is Madison Square Garden. So am I successful? Sure, but...
Well, it's something to aspire to.
Yeah,
and I don't
to
mean
me,
to say
Amy
that in a corny
Schumer
way.
Is successful.
Oh, I know. Yeah, sure.
She's successful.
But
so there's a discrepancy between where I'm at and where she's at. I have a great agent. I have a great manager. I got a commercial agent. I got a college agent.
But it's not a discrepancy. It's just a distance.
Big, yeah.
You know,
right.
That you would like to narrow.
Yeah. It's important to be, you know, okay with the process.
And you think you are?
No, I'm working on it. I mean, it's being okay with the process is a real process.
But 13 to 14 shows a week is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yes, you can always get more and be out there more. We're running out of time, but if I was your fairy godmother, what do you want from me?
Oh, if you were my fairy godmother, I got to say something like clean drinking water for everybody.
Yes. Peace. Yes, we get that.
And
I'm
world
talking
peace,
about
world peace. What would I want? I mean,
Emma.
I'm trying to think if it would be, how many things do I get?
You're pushing me. Yeah.
All right. I'm trying to negotiate. If I could have, you know, okay, wait. All right, what's that analogy where it's like you can take a horse to water,
but you can't make a drink.
Milk the horse. Wait, how does it go?
No, it's not. No,
I
you've got pasteurization on your head. No, you can take a horse to water. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make a drink.
Right.
And so?
Damn, that's the wrong analogy. That's the wrong thing.
You're getting too heavy.
Okay.
Do you want to headline the Ed Sullivan Show?
Well, I'm working on two sitcoms that I'm working on packaging. I've got a movie. I mean, ultimately, I want a late night talk show like an Edgy Ellen. Try to bring people together around great humor. That's a beautiful thing. So being a part of a process on that and the biggest level and greatest capacity that I can be at, that's what I want for my fairy godmother.
I'll see what I can do.
See what you can do.
Well, thank you so much
thank
for joining
you so much. I
today.
Appreciate it.
I think it was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much.
And I wish you a lot of success.
Thank you.
And we'll be hearing from Emma Willman. I know that.
Whoop, whoop.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.